Welcome back to the program. It is often said that to name something is to own it, or at least give it its meaning. This is generally true as a marketing concept. We would think it might be less true in an exacting field such as medicine. However, that has been the underlying idea of the American Psychiatric Association in creating and fostering the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual since 1952. A volume that tries to define the parameters and terms of mental illness is without the kind of scientific reliance used even for an auto repair manual. Yet the fifth volume of this work has just been completed. We've all heard of it, doctors rely on it, and it may in fact be detrimental to our mental health. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Gary Greenberg. Gary Greenberg is a practicing psychotherapist, the author of the previous book, Manufacturing Depression, and it is my pleasure to welcome him to the program today to talk about the Book of Woe, the DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Gary Greenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be back.
It's great to have you here. First of all, talk a little bit, for those that don't know, about the origins of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's something I think people have heard of, have some rough familiarity with, but talk a little bit about how it began back in 1952.
Well, it began in 1952 only because the government finally decided that it needed to have a single diagnostic manual. By then there were three or four out there. The Army had its own, and other parts of the government had their own. And they sort of deferred to the American Psychiatric Association, largely because the government didn't really want to do it anymore. So the Psychiatric Association, which had always been compiling these diagnostic manuals, basically got the franchise all to themselves.
And part of it was that it was also a profit center for them, in addition to supplying the information.
It wasn't not until 1980 that the DSM became a real moneymaker for the APA, and it was a surprise to them. The DSM got completely revamped in 1980 with a third edition, the DSM-3, because psychiatry had entered into one of its periodic crises in the 1970s, having to do largely with whether or not the psychiatrists knew what mental illness was and which mental illnesses exist. And so they had to revamp their diagnostic manual, and when they did that, they went over to a system called descriptive psychiatry, where they came up, as you were talking about earlier, they started naming disorders, hundreds of them, and coming up with lists of criteria by which the disorders were defined. And this was tremendously appealing to all sorts of people, bureaucrats, scientists, lawyers, who suddenly had this way to get a hold of mental illness that they hadn't had before, to use it to, for instance, get special services for kids in schools, or to get criminal defendants off of serious charges, or to decide what drugs to get approved. It was extremely popular for that reason, and it sold millions of copies. The DSM-4, which came out in 1994 and is still in effect until next week, in its 20 years of life, has earned more than $110 million for the APA.
One of the problems seems to be repeatedly that there is this disconnect between a diagnosis that may grow out of the DSM and the reality of the condition itself. Talk a little about that.
Well, the real disconnect is between the question of whether or not to name something is to do more than give us a way to wrap our heads around it. If we name a medical disorder, let's say pneumonia, then what we assume that means now is that you've identified a pathogen, a virus or a bacteria, that's causing a problem in the lungs. So those things, the virus and the bacteria, they are assumed to exist. The problem with psychiatric diagnosis and the disconnect that I think you're talking about is that when we name major depressive disorder, we're not really naming a thing outside the symptoms. We're simply saying this cluster of symptoms equals major depressive disorder, and major depressive disorder equals this cluster of symptoms. It's totally circular. And there's no way to distinguish between a person who meets those criteria and is sick, and a person who meets those criteria who isn't sick. And there can be people who meet the criteria who we really don't want to consider as sick. For instance, in the case of major depressive disorder, people who have had a recent bereavement. Those people will meet the criteria for depression, but is it really fair to say they're sick?
To what extent has this been used by insurance companies and drug companies?
Well, the insurance industry uses it probably against their will. I mean, it's been used by doctors to collect money, and I should say by mental health practitioners, of whom I am one. It's how we, if we want our patients to pay for their therapy with insurance dollars, it's how they get the money. You have to give them a diagnosis. And that's actually the major use, if you just, the frequency of use of the DSM, it's probably most frequently used in private offices or in hospitals to diagnose people for insurance purposes. And it's purely bureaucratic. Very little comes of the diagnosis. Treatments aren't tied to diagnoses very closely. Now, as far as the drug company is concerned, every DSM diagnosis is an opportunity. It's a market to find a target. It becomes a target for drug approval. The Food and Drug Administration used the DSM as the kind of standard by which drugs are measured. To get a drug approved, it has to have an indication. It has to have something that is treating. And the FDA really favors drugs that are going to treat a named disorder as opposed to a symptom. It's much easier to get a drug approved for, say, major depressive disorder than it is to get a drug approved for, say, fatness. So the drug companies, to them, it's a book full of bonanzas.
To what extent is this fifth revision different from number four?
It isn't. I think that's a really important point. The DSM-5 is not radically different from the DSM-4. There are some critics out there who want us to think that it is, but in fact, the similarities are much greater than the differences. There's a couple of new diagnoses out there, but there's a couple of diagnoses that are going away, and people will be shifted around from one category to another, but it's basically the same idea. It's just a tweaked version of the DSM-4.
And why are there those out there that want us to think that it is radically different?
Well, it's an interesting question. That criticism is coming mostly from within the psychiatric profession, largely from a single psychiatrist named Alan Francis, who was the guy who put together the DSM-4. And he's worried, and I think his worry is genuine, that the DSM-5 is going to make the problem of overdiagnosis and overtreatment worse. And he points to some specific changes that are being made, and I don't dispute that those changes are being made or that they will have that effect. But I think, to some extent, he wants the DSM-5 to be make the DSM-5 out to be worse than the other DSMs because he wants to protect the DSM. He wants to say, look, in general, the book is not bad, but this specific version of it is a bad thing. It's a one bad apples argument. You know, one bad apple doesn't spoil a whole bunch. Well, this one bad revision doesn't make the whole thing bad. And I think that there's an interest in doing that because most people know the DSM is a really fragile document. It doesn't have much science behind it. And they have to protect it, because without the DSM, psychiatry is in real trouble.
Talk a little bit about the process by which it's developed. You talk about it not having much science behind it. What is the process, not terribly transparent, by which it's developed?
Well, yes, and it's important to notice that it is not terribly transparent. The APA has decided to keep it secret, in fact. But I was able to get a pretty good sense of it. It's a legislative process. People have their ideas. They think that a certain disorder ought to be in the DSM or shouldn't be in the DSM, or that a certain disorder should have these criteria and not those criteria, and they fight with each other about it in committees. Now, the committees, not unlike many legislatures, are made up of people whose differences are big but not as big as they could be. They're made up of mostly like-minded people. So the disputes tend to be really niggling little disputes over arbitrary distinctions rather than huge questions of whether or not mental illnesses exist or whether or not this particular mental illness exists or whether or not the DSM is a good idea. And after they have those fights, they vote. And after they vote, they present their findings to another committee, and that committee passes them along to another committee. And finally, the entire membership of the American Psychiatric Association votes on it, and at the moment they do, certain diagnoses certain illnesses cease to exist, as homosexuality did in 1973, or as Asperger's cyst syndrome is going to next week, and other illnesses come into existence, like binge eating disorder will next week, or like Asperger's disorder did in 1994.
Is this something we should view in its totality as a medical document or as simply a public document?
Well, I think that we need to be more aware of the DSM as a public document, as a document that underlies a huge amount of public policy and it underlies the decisions about the expenditure of public money, particularly when it comes to research, but also when it comes to education and other areas of public expense. And the thing is that we have to understand that the APA is a private guild. So we have a private guild in charge of an enormous public trust, and that is a problem, particularly when the private guild in question doesn't seem to think it has a duty to be transparent to the public.
Why has the National Institute of Mental Health moved away from this? Why have they virtually abandoned it?
Well, they abandoned it a long time ago. The NIMH did not give any money to the APA for the DSM-5. It cost the APA $25 million to produce this document, or so they say. And the NIMH, from the beginning, said, we're not giving you any more money because you don't have anything new. So this isn't anything recent. And the reason they're moving away from it is because they feel that the DSM hamstrings research. It puts researchers in a position of having to conduct studies on mental disorders that don't necessarily exist in the same way that, you know, cancer or diabetes exist. And so they're stuck looking into these categories. It's like they go down the rabbit hole, and once they're down there, they have to live inside that world, and they have to research categories that they know aren't real. So what NIMH is trying to do is to say to the research community, look, you don't have to do that anymore. You can sort of put the DSM aside, and we want you to look differently at the whole question of how to understand and treat mental illness. We want you to look first at the brain and work from the brain outward instead of working from behavior back to the brain.
And that's really the aspect of the DSM that seems to be missing entirely, the connection to any kind of biological findings or biological link to some of these mental illnesses.
Yes, that's true. And that's not because, you know, there's a conspiracy to cover it up. It's because nobody knows. The brain science is in its infancy. And the brain is possibly the most complicated object in the universe. And so the understanding of it is nowhere near where it would need to be in order to be able to say even the most simple things about how people, you know, about people's experiences, about their suffering, about their behavior, let alone to get at something as complex as, you know, depression or anxiety. So the DSM has always gone on the assumption that sooner or later we're going to find the underlying causes of, let's say, depression. And in the meantime, we're just going to pretend like we know that this thing exists. Unfortunately, the science hasn't come in, and to the extent that it has come in, it makes it clear that something like major depressive disorder is never going to show up in the brain because it doesn't really exist that way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the changes that have taken place. Asperger's, you mentioned before, that's something that gained recognition at one point and now is gone. What transpired there?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, my reading of it is that the Asperger's came into being in 1994, and to the surprise of the people who created the DSM, it became a very common, popular diagnosis. Two things happened as a result. One of them is that school services, because most Asperger's diagnosis is for kids, the school services, the school money was really strained. And as a result of that, a lot of school systems started cutting back on the services they would provide for Asperger's kids. So in one way, it's an attempt to, the idea is that the Asperger's diagnosis is going to be folded into the autism diagnosis, and the idea there is that they will provide services for autism. Now, you can hear right there, that's not a scientific notion. That's a legislative notion. That's a policy decision made by the APA to help people get services. So that's one thing that happened. Another thing that happened, and this is maybe more important, is that Asperger's was so popular as a diagnosis that it got out of hand. Too many people wanted to be Asperger's because it gave them a way to understand their awkwardness, their social failures, and so on. And it contextualized it as a medical disorder, and it created a community. It created a whole group of people who could share the fact that they had this diagnosis. And while that's, I believe, a good thing, it doesn't sound very medical, and I think it became an embarrassment to the APA.
To what extent is the APA aware that essentially what it's engaged in, you referred to it as a legislative process, a political process, really, in the creation of this?
I think to a great extent. I mean, you know, if you sit down with psychiatrists, or as I've done, just hang out around them and listen to them talk to each other, then you see that they're not deluded. They know what's going on. You know, one of the things that I found interesting about writing this book, and I think readers are finding interesting, is that it's not like I've uncovered anything here. I've just reported what psychiatrists say. And so they're aware of it. The question is, two questions. One is, can they do anything about it? I think the answer to that is right now, no. And the second one is, do they want us to know about it? And I think the answer to that question is also no. I think psychiatrists talk differently to each other from the way they talk to us, because they know this doesn't sound good. They know that if they admit that they don't really have real diseases in their diagnostic manual, that that's going to create a crisis of confidence. And they've had those periodically throughout their history.
And what is, in your view, having looked at this for as long as you have, what are the consequences in terms of mental health treatment in this country, and is it doing more good than harm, or more harm than good?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody does. I mean, the harms that it's doing are the kinds that have to do with let me take a step back on this. When diagnosis and treatment are not connected in the way that we think they are, at least not in psychiatry. So it would be unfair to say that a consequence of the DSM is this really obvious upsurge in the use of psychiatric medications. Most of the prescriptions that are written for most of the psychiatric drugs are written without the benefit of a psychiatric diagnosis. So that consequence, which is the obvious one, probably isn't so important. But on the other hand, the consequence of telling people that they're sick when they have when they're suffering mentally, that has the consequence of changing the way we understand our lives. To just go around with the notion that my sadness or whatever it is a disease called depression, it changes the way I'm going to understand it, the way I'm going to think about it, the way I'm going to deal with it, whether or not I'm willing to take drugs for it. It changes the demands that we make on our society changes. So I think that the consequences, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, the DSM allows psychiatrists to talk to each other. It allows them to get these resources from the healthcare system. On the other hand, it pathologizes the population in ways that may not be so good.
How does it relate, a little more specifically, to some of the changes that we're seeing take place in healthcare now? And to what extent is the DSM becoming even more important within the context of the healthcare debate these days?
Well, you know, it's not clear how that's going to shake out. In the beginning, the Obama administration's healthcare plan is going to increase services or resources, at least if the money is there to begin with, because part of the health care plan is a much more detailed and rigorous rule that mental health treatment is going to have to be paid for at the same level as physical health treatment. But in the long run, what you have is the DSM is the keys to the health care case when it comes to mental illness. And I think what's going to happen here is it's going to become one of those forces that is creating a weakness in our healthcare system. That, or a better way of saying that, is that I think what the DSM is going to do is going to put more strain on the healthcare system. And we have a very strange way of financing healthcare in this society, and I think the DSM is just going to make that stranger.
And how are psychiatrists today looking at those problems, and what are they saying to each other about this?
I think that psychiatrists are worried. I think they're worried that they're going to get left behind, left out. That the work that they do is going to be shoved aside because, you know, you have to ration the money. And I think that they're worried that if the DSM-5 is a debacle, that it will give credence to the forces that would like to deprive the mental health system of resources.
Gary Greenberg. His book is The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Gary, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, I was glad to be here.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.